You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking American League East with MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. The division has been settled. The Orioles have secured first place. They have secured a home field in the American League Division Series, and we will be talking to Brittany Giroli about playoff preparation and how deep the Orioles can go in October. We'll be talking to Brian Hoke and Gregor Chisholm about the final gasps of the Yankees and Blue Jays, two teams that hung around the postseason race till the end, and of course talking a little Derek Jeter. We'll be talking to Bill Chastain and Ian Brown about how the Rays and Red Sox, two popular preseason picks to win the division, get back on top. It was a surprising division, an interesting division this year, and we'll be looking back and looking ahead. Thanks, everybody, for listening to MLB.com Extras. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. Brittany, it looks as though the Orioles rotation is taking at least some shape for the postseason. We had a pretty good idea who number one would be, but based on your understanding, what do we know for sure right now, and what do we have a pretty good read on for when the division series gets started?
Well, we don't know anything for sure. Buck hasn't officially named anybody, so it's kind of a waiting game with that, so not a whole lot officially, but like you said, you can kind of connect the dots a little bit. Buck kind of joked around yesterday when I asked him about it. He said that they will have four starters, which I think everyone kind of expected. They don't really have that ace guy that you feel the need to try and bring back on 3 days' rest. Chris Hillman will probably be the first starter, probably be the game one guy, the way it's plots up right now. I think you can kind of mix and match after that, depending on what time the game is. But Norris doesn't pitch well in day games. You have Lefty Wei and Chen, depending on, again, the matchup. Who do you want him to face? When? Where is that game? Things like that all play into it. But I do think that Miguel Gonzalez is going to be in that rotation as well. Kevin Gausman and me, it looks like the guy that's going to go to the bullpen. He's never pitched this late in the season. He's just 23 years old. And, of course, he was a big part of their success in the bullpen last year. He did a really nice job for them, pitching in relief, found his niche a little bit down the stretch. So it's not foreign to him, and I think that probably is the way that best sets up the Orioles for the postseason.
Right. We've talked about this a little before, but is it safe to say, or at least likely, that Gausman wouldn't just be a mop-up guy? If he's in the bullpen, he's a viable option to get some relevant innings?
Yeah, I don't know how many mop-up guys are 97, 98, the way that Kevin Gausman does in any short stints like that. So, yes, I would agree with that.
What kind of options does he give them? I mean, he's such an intriguing guy. He's got, you know, he's a guy I think a lot of clubs would be in the postseason rotation. What kind of option does he offer as a potential postseason reliever?
Well, he's a power righty. You know, he's another alternative to a guy like Tommy Hunter. He's also capable of dialing it up into the upper 90s. And that bullpen is so good. It's interesting because I was talking to Dandy Cat the other day about, well, what makes this bullpen so successful, and they just have so many looks and so many different weapons to throw at you. Adding a guy like Kevin Gausman means maybe you can use him a little bit earlier in the game, maybe use Tommy Hunter earlier than you would like, play matchups, you know, batter to batter. There are things in the postseason with the way it's set up, and most teams predominantly go with the 11 pitchers. There are ways to use those guys to your advantage. And Kevin Gausman, like I said, has pitched well in the bullpen. He's shown an ability to do it, and he doesn't seem to be fazed coming in the middle of the inning, runners on, things like that. So I think the way it's set up right now, he's a guy that certainly could help them, could be a guy who would get meaningful out in that sixth, seventh inning, possibly even later, depending on, again, who they're facing, what's going on. I wouldn't eliminate, especially with manager Buck Showalter and the way he's not afraid to take risks, I wouldn't eliminate Kevin Gausman pitching really in any inning in any form or fashion as long as it helps the Baltimore Orioles win.
Are there still roster decisions to be made? Are there still significant questions as far as who's actually on the roster?
Sure. I think until Tuesday, there's always going to be questions. I mean, what do you do at third base? They've had four errors there, I think, in the last five games. You look at that infield today, and it looks kind of like an ALDS tryout almost. You got Ryan Flaherty playing first base. You got Kelly Johnson. at second base. You got Jimmy Paredes at third. So what do you do? I don't see all three of those guys on the club. I think maybe two of the three. So what do you do there? Alejandro de Alza has been excellent. I think he's very deserving. He's probably earned himself a spot in the outfield on that roster. So how this shakes out, I think the infield is really the big question, what they end up doing. And, of course, the real question is what do they do if they advance? Do they activate Chris Davis? Do they add him? Is it worth it? And I think also what's going to play into it is Steve Pearson, his wrist. He hasn't played in the last couple of days. Like I said, right now that's not really impacting their roster decisions, but certainly it could, especially if this is a nagging thing, if this is something that they don't feel has really resolved itself in Toronto. They could look a little closer at that situation and say, maybe we need to take another infielder.
What is your read on the situation with Pearce? I mean, he's been such a big part, and particularly with Davis out, he is really an essential part of this offense. You mentioned it's still somewhat uncertain. Is that something that the club is worried about, or are they still pretty confident that given another week he'll be fine?
They feel pretty confident because, like you said, they don't play a meaningful game here until next Thursday. So the way it's set up right now, they gave Nick Markakis a whole bunch of time off, almost a week. Adam Jones had a bunch of days off. With Steve Pearce, he's got a history of wrist issues. He said he had some discomfort over the weekend, so they immediately shut him down, scratched him from Saturday's lineup, gave him that cortisone shot. So he's shut down anyway for a couple days after that injection. I think we'll have a better idea in the next day or two if he starts doing baseball stuff and starts to get back into the flow of the game in Toronto. They'd be a lot less worried. But certainly Buck has sat him down. He's made him aware that, look, the team needs you. We need to get you right. Part of the problem with Steve Pearce is he's a guy who's always had to fight for a spot, but he's a guy who has always been out there taking 100 swings and doing early BP and doing everything necessary because he's so used to clawing and scratching and fighting for every pinch hit, for every late-game replacement that he's been. Well, he's a starter here. They're reliant on him. So Buck kind of joked around that they're going to have to make sure he's not allowed, that they lock all the cages here at Yankee Stadium, that he has a small hotel room so that he doesn't bring home any bats so that he can't try and practice and get it right, because you can just tell that this is killing him right now. They need him, but they don't need him over these next couple days. So it's an interesting balance right now with Steve Pearce, but I don't think they're all that concerned just yet.
It seems most likely, it's not set in stone, but it seems most likely that the Orioles' opponent in the division series will be the AL Central champion. And it's kind of an interesting pair of matchups because the way that the O's score runs is by hitting the ball out of the park. They're not really a team that's going to – they're decent at getting on base, but really it's about hitting the ball out of the park. And you've got two very different pitching staffs, a Detroit pitching staff that relies on the strikeout, a Kansas City pitching staff that has balls in play and catches the ball. Do you feel like one or the other of those opponents is a better matchup for this Orioles team?
I think the Royals probably are. You mentioned the Tigers being a pitching staff that's got a lot of strikeouts. The Orioles hit a lot of home runs. They're also very strikeout-prone lineup, even without Chris Davis. They are very much a go bigger or go home type of lineup. So I feel like Detroit, you know, is not that great of a matchup pitching-wise. Now, then you look at that lineup, and of course you've got the tandem of Cabrera and Martinez, who Buck talks about all the time. It's just such an important part of the equation there with what they're able to do. So I think the Royals also, just because they haven't been here in so long, if they get to the postseason, there could be a certain element of nerves, a lot of uncertainty for guys like that. I think Detroit, this is business as usual. I think they're a more lethal team for the Orioles to face than Kansas City.
Yeah, that's actually exactly the reason I ask, because you think about the A's, who it's not exactly the same kind of offense as the Orioles, but again, it's an offense that relies more on hitting the ball out of the park than on hitting singles, and that's a team that's had a lot of trouble with Detroit in the past couple of years. So it is interesting that how much the matchups come into this. When we look at this team, what do you think is the biggest worry? Or maybe more accurately, because I'm sure the answer there is they don't worry, but what do you think is the thing that is most vulnerable or the most likely to get exposed in a short postseason series?
Well, probably the offense. I mean, if you saw that last night, they got held to one hit by Pineda here at Yankee Stadium. Certainly looked pretty close to lifeless, and that was with Adam Jones and Nick Markakis playing. Now, Steve Pearce isn't in the lineup, but, you know, they were pretty close to a regular lineup last night. When you go back to 2012, what really shut down for them was two things, really. The offense, all of a sudden couldn't hit, because like I said, they've always been a powerful lineup prone to the strikeout, and that can be difficult because if you're striking out left and right, it's very hard to get things going to manufacture that run. And that, and of course, the ninth inning, Jim Johnson blew a lot of saves in 2012. I think this bullpen is better than 2012. So to me, I think the biggest issue is going to be the lineup. I think the starting pitching has proven that they're consistent. They can hang with the other team. Are they going to get eight scoreless innings and 12 strikeouts out of their rotation? Probably not. But I feel like if they can keep it close, it's really going to come down to this lineup and whether some of these big guys, the Adam Joneses, the Nelson Cruzes, can step up for them in the spotlight and when the pressure is on.
And then the flip side of that, what's the biggest reason to think that this team has a deep run in it?
The pitching. It's got to be. Like I just said, their ability to shorten games. They only really need five, maybe not even six innings out of their starters. They are just so dominant. They've got lefty Andrew Miller, who is just a game changer to me. It allows you to have Brian Mattis. He is situational lefty. And Miller has been dominant. He's probably going to get closer money this winter. And you've got Darren O'Day back there, who's been phenomenal. ERA's been around less than one for most of the year. And closer Zach Britton, who is a ground ball guy, has really taken all the drama out of that ninth inning. So it's shortened up the game so much for them. And that, in combination with the starting pitching and the way that they've come together and stepped forward with new pitching coach Dave Wallace, new bullpen coach Tom Cheedy, who they call co-pitching coaches, to me, that's what's going to carry this team if they're going to get to the World Series.
All right. Well, Brittany Giroli, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter Brian Hoke. Brian, as we speak at this exact moment, the Yankees are not technically eliminated. They are still clinging to some postseason hope. But I think even within the clubhouse, they'd admit that the math doesn't look good. So while we don't have to quite call it a season yet, I don't think it's too soon to ask, in really simple, broad terms, what happened to the 2014 Yankees, a team that had really high expectations coming into the year.
Yeah, they would need a lot of help, and they'd probably have to run the table. So I think that even Joe Girardi, who is an optimist among optimists, would acknowledge that the math is against them. But I think when you look back at this season, you're going to think of two things. You're going to think of it was Derek Jeter's final year, and two, the offense just didn't hit. They were so inconsistent. I think that if you said in spring training they were going to lose four-fifths of the opening day rotation, you would have thought that pitching would be the problem. It really wasn't. The starting pitching, not just the five guys they started the year with, but really they mixed and matched and were able to get good starting pitching throughout the entire year. And the bullpen was a strength throughout the year. It's just, you look at these names on paper, the guys like Brian McCann, Mark Teixeira, Carlos Beltran, in the heart of that order, you think they would have hit, and they just really couldn't get it together. They've hit a little bit better of late, but it might be too little too late.
So as they go into 2015, there is no such thing as a year where it's okay to be okay in the Bronx. So what do they need, and what are they going to try and do this winter as they try and get back to where they expect to be in 2015?
Well, I think the first thing you're going to have to do, obviously, there's a vacancy at shortstop. And the guys that the Yankees have auditioned this year, if you look at Stephen Drew or Brendan Ryan, I think they're probably going to look outside the organization and try to upgrade that. So, you know, just throwing a name out there, I think J.J. Hardy would be a terrific fit. I think that I could see the Yankees going after him for a 3 or 4 year deal. Obviously, somebody has to replace Derek Jeter. You could do a lot worse than bringing in a veteran like that. I think to some extent you cross your fingers and you hope that Brian McCann's second half was the real Brian McCann, and that's what you'll get. You hope that Mark Teixeira will come back healthy. You hope that A-Rod can come back and be something productive. You hope that Jacoby Ellsbury can stay healthy and be productive. Yep. Same goes for Brett Gardner. So I think that maybe there's not as much to do as it might look like. Obviously, Carlos Beltran would be a huge factor in that. Maybe they go after a guy like Nelson Cruz or Victor Martinez, or maybe they just throw a bunch of money at guys like John Lester and Max Scherzer and try and make pitching into even more of a strength. So I think that there's money to spend. If the Steinbrenner's history has shown us anything, it's that when the team does not make the playoffs, they spend big. That is their game plan. That's out of the playbook. It is something needs to happen, headlines need to be made, there's money to be spent, write a check. So that's what I expect to happen. We'll see how it all plays out. It takes two to tango. Players need to take that money, but I think the Steinbrenners will be willing to open up the checkbook.
You kind of led into my next question, which is if there's not a lot that can be done about the offense, there may be some things that can be done. It does seem like this is a market where there are starting pitchers to be had. There are quality starting pitchers. They may, in some cases, be risky. A guy like Scherzer, I think some people think maybe is a little bit of a worry health-wise, and just he doesn't have that long history of success. But there are at least three guys on the market who look like real impact starters, maybe more than that, depending on how much you like some guys. Is that maybe what this team does this winter, is look to improve by building a really formidable front of the rotation with a Scherzer or a Lester to pair with Pineda and hopefully Tanaka?
Well, here's the problem, and as good as the rotation has been with guys filling in, there's a lot of question marks for next year. I think that CC Sabathia is a big question mark. Pineda, he's looked great when he's on the mound, but he's barely pitched in the last couple of years in his time as a Yankee. So I think he's a question mark until he proves otherwise. Tanaka is a huge question mark. I think that Ivan Novo, you're probably not going to get him back until May at the earliest, so you start there. I would start, if I were the Yankees, I would consider signing Brandon McCarthy. I think that he's been terrific since he came from Arizona. He really likes being in the clubhouse. He fit right in. He's enjoyed success in New York. I think he's a perfect fit. And given the amount of questions you have, you don't know if John Lester or Max Scherzer or any of these guys are going to take the Yankees' money. I think that McCarthy's a guy who you can pencil in right now. He can be a solid two or a three for you. It seems like he's very interested in staying. I think that would be one of the first moves I would make if I were the Yankees and Brian Cashman this offseason. Of course, they have to deal with Brian Cashman as well. His contract will be expiring, but it sounds like he will be coming back to call the shots. So I think that McCarthy should be high on his priority list.
You know as well as I do, though, that if that's – and I'm not suggesting that you're saying it will be, but if that's the move, that doesn't get it done. Am I understanding that maybe there is some hesitation because of – a couple of big pitcher contracts already on the books that they might hesitate to put out a big contract for another starting pitcher? Is that kind of the thought process, that they're just maybe a little gun-shy?
Well, I think you've already seen the best of what CC Sabathia is going to give you on that deal. I think that, you know, you're paying him a lot of money on the back end, but you went into the deal knowing that. I think that Tanaka, giving him $175, I know there's an opt-out, but let's call it 7 years. For right now, I think that's a huge gamble. Right now, is it going to pay off? Looks great if you can avoid Tommy John. If not, then you know, you lose him for a year. I think that the Yankees will be willing to spend money on free agency if it's an elite type guy like a Lester, like a Scherzer, like we've been talking about. But I think that those guys are probably not going to come off the board very quickly. So in my mind, if you can get a guy like McCarthy and lock him up in October or November, and then at least you have something solid that you can say, that is in hand, that is going to spring training with us next year, 2015, 2016, I think that's a huge plus.
We've had a couple of looks at McCarthy on Yankees.com, and it seems that this is more than just a hot streak. Are you buying that this guy is at least a middle rotation starter in the American League East?
Oh, I'm buying it. Yeah, no, I'm buying. I think he's proven that. I don't think it's a fluke that he's been able to come over and succeed the way he has. I mean, really, his problem has been staying on the mound. He's not the kind of guy that you can count on and pencil in for 180, 200 innings. He's never done that in his career. But I think that if they can keep him on track, it seems like he and Larry Rothschild have worked very well together. I think that it's huge for him to have that comfort level and to be able to stick there in that rotation. I think that he really enjoyed the idea of being able to flush the first half of the season and kind of wipe that clean and start fresh in New York. So I think he's responded to it.
We did talk a little bit about Masahiro Tanaka, and he's obviously an enormous part of whatever success or failure this club has next year. What did they take out of that first start back? What's the level of optimism? What's the level of confidence as far as what he will be able to offer next year?
I think as of right now, you cross your fingers. Look, he showed enough that he can go out and get big league hitters out. I think that's a plus. pitched really well. I think he exceeded expectations. The fact that he came back the next day and played catch and didn't seem to have any issue doing that, I think that's huge. He'll get one more shot. He can go into Fenway Park. It's going to be a big festive atmosphere. It's Yankees, Red Sox. It's Derek Jeter's final weekend. The adrenaline will be going. And I think that really the Yankees, they have their fingers crossed. They hope that he can continue to do it. If it is a catastrophic blowout, you're going to see it. He can't hide it. You know, there would be a situation where he walks off the mound, and then at least you know. At least you know going into the winter what you have. But as of right now, it seems like Tanaka's confidence is high. He used the word relieved to talk about his feelings after that game. I think there's a lot of relief on the part of the entire organization that this guy might be able to avoid surgery. And look, Adam Wainwright went half a decade without having surgery. So I think that it's possible. It maybe not be probable, but it is possible. So, you know, the Yankees just have to kind of hope that the dice rolls in their favor.
I think it's fair to say there is one other pretty big question facing this club as the winter approaches, and that's the ninth inning. They've seen that they've got a guy who could at least be considered as a possible replacement for David Robertson if David Robertson leaves, but it seems like they also are awfully fond of Robertson. What do you think happens with Robertson, and what do you think happens with the back of that bullpen for 2015?
And well, it seems like Robertson's intent on testing free agency, and I'm not surprised at that. I think that he's earned that right, and he's going to get some good offers out there for sure. You know, I think that the Red Sox could be one team that's interested. You know, we've talked about it a few times over the last few weeks. The best thing you can say about Robertson is you really haven't heard so many people say if Mariano Rivera was here that it wouldn't be like this. Robertson, I mean, I know he stumbled a couple times, but so did Rivera. I think that he's done a really good job stepping in and doing that in New York, following the all-time saves leader. I think there's something to be said about that. Betances has been an electric setup man. I think you could put him in the closer role and he would succeed. Not too much seems to rattle him, but if you can keep Betances as your 4 or 5 out guy in the 7th and 8th innings, and then you can count on Robertson in 9th, I think that that is a strength, and I don't see any reason to dismantle that. So I expect the Yankees to at least make Robertson a qualifying offer. Maybe he takes that. Who knows? You know, it should be about $15 million. That would be a big pay raise for him. But more likely, I think that he's going to be in the market for at least a 2 or 3 year deal. And, you know, the Yankees should fight hard and think about that, I think. You know, he's a homegrown talent. They tend to take care of their homegrown talents. I know that Robbie Cano is the exception. But if you look at Brett Gardner, for example, this is a guy who came up through the organization. They rewarded him with a 4-year, $52 million contract. Robertson is a homegrown product. He's done it in New York. He succeeded. He knows the quote-unquote Yankee way. I think that that is valuable.
All right. Well, Brian Hoke, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras, talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, we speak at this moment with the Jays having virtually no chance, but still the faintest hope. But I think we can talk about what happened at this point. So my big question is a pretty simple one. What happened?
Yeah, really, it's been an amazing season of extremes for this team. I mean, it's something that John Gibbons liked to talk an awful lot about this year, just how, you know, the team he had was basically polar opposites. I mean, one month they looked incredibly good, and then the next they looked incredibly bad. And, you know, I think, you know, you go back to this was a team that it had flaws in several areas that I think were masked during a very strong run in May, but it's a team that relied on the home run for the vast majority of its production. And when they lost a couple guys in that lineup, whether it was Edwin Encarnacion and Adam Lind during July and August, or guys like Brett Laurie, I mean, their presence was really missed, and that kind of started a bit of a downfall. And then with that, I think, you know, a main reason behind the struggles in the second half was an overall lack of depth within that organization. I think they really weren't able to fill the gaps for when they had guys that did go down with injury. And I think that was a big part of it. And then there were some defensive issues, just like there were last year, that ended up costing the team some additional runs. And the bullpen didn't perform like it did in 2013. So there's multiple things that you can point to on this team. But it really is kind of a stark contrast from where this team was in May and June and the golden opportunity that it seemed to have at the time and where they finished up the season.
It's kind of hard to ask this because this could still very well be an 84-85 win team. They've got a pretty decent run differential. I think it's fair to say that on the balance, this team was basically good enough to be a postseason team with a couple of breaks. With that said, this is 2 years in a row that a very high-expenditure, high-expectation Toronto team has fallen short of what the expectations were. And so I wonder, are there any rumblings about any kind of consequences, changes, coaching staff, manager, front office, anything? Or is this just a case where they look at it and say, you know what, we gave it a good shot, it didn't work?
Yeah, you know, that's going to be a real interesting question over the next couple of weeks. And, you know, Alex Anthopoulos was given an opportunity to issue a vote of confidence to John Gibbons a week ago. And, you know, he issued a slight vote of confidence, but it wasn't as strong as I was necessarily expecting. I still think that John Gibbons will be back. You know, he has a pretty good relationship with Alex Anthopoulos, but ultimately, I think what a lot of this comes down to is also going to be the future of President Paul Beeston. I mean, his contract is up at the end of October, and whether or not he returns, I think, is a big piece that will impact a lot of the decisions that this team makes moving forward. You know, Beeston was the guy who personally brought in Alex Anthopoulos, and then Alex was the guy who made the decision to bring back Gibbons. And that was something that Beeston admittedly and openly didn't necessarily agree with at the time. So I think, you know, but the three of those guys have a very strong working relationship. But if Beeston decides to step aside and either retire or pursue other endeavors, I think there is a potential there for a trickle-down effect where you could see other changes. I don't think that will impact Alex Anthopoulos. I fully expect him to come back next year. But, you know, the coaching situation is a little bit up in the air. But, you know, as Alex has pointed out in the past, you know, I don't think the Blue Jays would be in a much different situation if they had a different manager. For the most part, John Gibbons is a very good in-game manager. The issues with this team over the past year go well beyond that. And, I mean, as we've touched on, there's some depth issues that they really need to work on. And there are some moves that, I mean, let's be honest, that didn't really quite work out for this organization. So, you know, I think they believe that they have one last shot at this. I think next year, this isn't a team that's about to rebuild and start over anytime soon. I think that, if anything, that this season this year gave them a little bit of hope that with some more changes of this offseason, with some minor adjustments and some additions, that next year can be their year. But it really is next year or bust for this current core, because you have a lot of guys that have been locked up for a certain period of time, and that time really comes to an end at the end of next year.
How have these 2 years been received within the market, among the fan base, among the media? There, like I said, and as you well know, there were very high expectations for these two clubs. Is there a level of understanding, or is there frustration with how the results have gone the past two seasons?
There's definitely frustration, and you know, a lot of it is very understandable. I mean, this is an organization that hasn't been to the postseason since 1993. There's been an awful lot of heartache in the city, not just with the Blue Jays, but with the other professional sports teams as well. So it's, in terms of a sports fan base, it's a very jaded city right now. And, you know, you look at what happened last year, and the expectations were just through the roof for that team, and the ticket sales were through the roof during the off season, and it seemed like Toronto was on the verge of becoming, you know, a baseball city again, just like it was in the heyday during those early 90s. Everyone really bought in. And then just the way last year went, I mean, everything fell apart basically within the span of 6 weeks. So, I mean, they didn't even really get any kind of taste of competitive baseball last year. And I think that there was kind of a hangover effect going into this offseason and early on this year. I think there were a lot of fans who were skeptical throughout spring training and April and even very early May. But then the Blue Jays went on that really big winning streak in May and took over first spot, and here they were in June and into July holding on to a spot for the postseason. So I think there was a little bit even more renewed hope within the city that, okay, finally this could be the year. And, you know, this is the season that they finally did what they were supposed to do a year ago. And then to have things go the way they did, especially during the month of August, it was, you know, kind of watching the results and the standings so slowly fall apart day by day. There's no question there's frustration. And this is a city that, that desperately wants some postseason baseball. And it's, so far, it's been something that they haven't been able to see for a very, very long time.
One thing you noted, and one thing I think makes this a really interesting club, is that basically the roster is back. I mean, there's not a whole lot that you expect to change, either in the lineup or the rotation. I mean, there's some question, I guess, about Melky Cabrera. There's some question about the bullpen. But by and large, it seems like this team looks pretty similar next year. So that, to me, leads to the question, how does this team get better? How does this team take that step from being on the fringes of contention to being a very real challenger of the division?
Yeah, there's a couple things that they definitely have to address this offseason. I mean, one is the one that you touched on, Melky Cabrera. I think that's going to be a top priority for this team, trying to bring him back. But he's, as you mentioned, he's a guy who's already been there, so they need to make some changes above and beyond that. They're going to need to do something with second base that has been kind of a black hole for this organization now for a number of years. They've tried seemingly every year there's somebody new that gets an opportunity but isn't able to hang on to that job. And then above and beyond that, you're going to need some additions in the bullpen. And then I think a lot of the hope within this organization really lies within its young starting pitching and its young pitchers that are coming up. You know, I think what the Blue Jays saw this year out of Marcus Stroman, I think really gives them hope that he can be, at the very least, kind of a mid-rotation arm next year. And then the hope is that guys will follow his path, with guys like Aaron Sanchez and Daniel Norris. And so the pitching side of things looks pretty bright. And the offensive side of things, I mean, that's where it was a disappointing finish to the year, but that's where a lot of the talent on that current roster lies, and that those guys are ready to win now. The core of Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, Jose Reyes, they need to be able to add to those pieces, find a way to keep a guy like Brett Laurie healthy, and just overall add some depth so when they do have injuries, which is going to happen every single year, but they need to have some players who can come in and help fill the void and at least bridge the gap while some of their top players are out.
All right, well, Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter Bill Chastain. Bill, this was a season with really high expectations for the Rays. I picked them not only to win the division, but to win the American League, and I was certainly not the only one. We've talked a lot over the last few weeks about kind of what has happened here, but overall, in the big picture, what happened with this team this year?
Well, you know, I think it's just guys that they thought were going to do well. I mean, and just like you said, I mean, I was the same way as you. I thought they had a great team on paper. Aside from injuries, they just got underperformance, I think. And so that's going to lead them in the offseason to make some hard decisions and probably try not to – they're probably going to have to try not to overreact to generally just – a lot of guys had bad years.
How much of that is sort of reasonably explained of the guys who didn't perform up to expectations, and how many of those things really are sort of concerning going forward?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of them are concerning in that, you know, the Rays are a small market team and the contracts they have. I mean, for example, you've got Grant Balfour. They brought him in. They wanted him to be the closer. They're on the hook for $7 million with him next year. He's closing the season out nice, which gives you some hope, but you know, they've kind of saddled up with Jake McGee and Boxberger as their back-end guys. So I think they're kind of stuck with him. It's kind of a shotgun marriage for next year. Same thing with Escobar. You know, they extended Escobar. He's not been the same guy who he was last year at shortstop. They've got to kind of ride it out with him. Several examples like that. Longoria, you know, you thought that Longoria, if he was healthy, puts the numbers up. And his numbers are starting to look better, but it just wasn't the typical Longoria year. And, you know, based on his status with the team, I mean, he has been the best hitter in the lineup ever since he's been here pretty much. And I still think he holds that status. But it was kind of a down year for him. So they've got a lot of little things like this going in the off season. They have to, and it's going to be a tough job to figure out what's real and what isn't.
What does this club need this winter, with the acknowledgement that they may not be able or willing to do a lot major to the roster beyond just getting guys back to performing like expected? What does this club hope to accomplish over the winter?
Well, you look at it, and they need more offense. Now, offense is at a premium now, so do they cut payroll to try and bring in a big offense guy? I'm not sure who's out there available. I mean, offense to me now has become what pitching used to be. Pitching seems to be more common now than offense, so that's, you know, it's more of a premium. So I'm not sure they're going to be able to go out and get that guy that's going to, you know, be the big bopper to put in that lineup. Now, having said that, I think one thing that's kind of misleading about this year is their starting pitching has always been the cornerstone of what they do. And really, during the bad stretch at the start of the season, that's when they kind of got in a jam, and their starting pitching wasn't what it was. They had a lot of injuries. Cobb wasn't there. Moore was out for the season. Jake Odorizzi was finding his way. Even Price was struggling a little bit at the beginning. Of course, they don't have Price anymore. But they will go back into next season with a very strong group of starters, and I think they've got that to depend on. You know, they've got that in their corner that they can start on, which is, you know, a pretty good foundation that they thought they had this year, and they really didn't at the start of the year. So I think going in next year, they're going to have solid starting pitching. They're going to have a lot of bullpen candidates. And then, you know, I think they'll be banking on hopefully some of these guys will come through more on offense. But I really don't see being able to go outside of the organization to bring the offense in that they might, you know, would like to have.
And that was something I wanted to ask you about as well. The offense, the rotation looks awfully good. And in fact, it looks like they might, depending on Matt Moore's status, have more pitchers than spots. What do they do? Do they view it as just enough? Do they view it as any kind of a surplus that maybe they might be able to deal from? Or how do they view that rotation as they go into spring?
I think they always view their starting, and I've heard Andrew Friedman talk about it many times, you always want to go into spring and go into the season with a depth of starting pitching, because that is the one thing they feel like they can't go to market to go out and buy. So this year they're really going in, you know, you're looking at, you got Odorizzi, Bruce Smiley, Cobb, Hellickson, and Archer are your starting five. And then you've got, backing them up, you've got Nathan Kearns, Alex Colome, and of course Matt Moore should be back at the latest in June. So that's eight guys. Now Colome is out of options, so should somebody go down, he might slip into the starting rotation. Otherwise, they'd probably slip him in as another bullpen guy, and he's got a pretty big arm, so he could be an impact guy at the bullpen. But, you know, again, I think they want as much depth at starting pitching as they can handle, because that is their strength. And you know, for the way they pitched this year, it really is almost astounding that they aren't better off. But there was that lapse really kind of the first 2 months that I think is kind of forgotten.
And the other thing that it seems to be might be a possibility if they wanted to go the trade route instead of free agency, one guy we talked about all year that didn't get dealt was Ben Zobrist. Now, there's a certain irony here that we were just talking about how they need offense, and Zobrist has consistently been one of their best players. With that said, I think he's a guy who draws a lot of interest from a lot of places, and we've also talked a good bit about Nick Franklin potentially being the new Zobrist. So given that combination of factors, is there a chance they move Zobrist maybe for a couple of pieces or whatever it might be? Do you expect Zobrist to report to camp with this club next year, or do you think he's a guy who might get moved?
I think it's, I think it's 50-50. I mean, but this guy, you know, he's so valuable. You look at right now, Escobar got hurt last night and probably won't play the rest of the season. He just moves Zobrist right over there to shortstop. And you got he might not have the range, you know, it's a little more limited range, but, you know, he's certainly a solid catch and throw guy. You know, and you can move him around at certain, you know, all over the place. And basically you got a starter who can play other positions. So I do think that there is a lot of value there. What they could get for him, I don't know. They do seem to be taking a pretty good look at Nick Franklin. Zobrist will be making $7 million. You know, do you cut that and do a platoon at shortstop and second, I mean, at second base with Forsythe and Franklin, and then maybe on occasion you have Franklin play some shortstop? It is an option that's open to them, and I think they, you know, will have a lot of people come to them to try and see what they would like for Zobrist.
This is an organization that tends to be very rational and also tends not to worry about doing unconventional things. Still, even with that, is there any more hesitation to deal Zobrist just because of his importance sort of organizationally in the clubhouse? They were willing to part with Price, so I guess to some extent they're willing to part with anybody, but it seems like the culture is such a big part of what they try to do there. Does that complicate things? So the fact that he's such a central guy, such a long-time guy, complicate the baseball decision and the financial decision of what they do with Zobrist?
I think it's certainly a part of the equation, but, you know, you can't find a guy who was more integral to what they do than James Shields. I mean, he was the guy who came in and gave them the foundation for their pitchers, you know, kind of laid the groundwork for what they do, showed them how to work hard, the whole bit, and, you know, and kind of his legacy carried on through Price and now Cobb. So I think if you can trade to James Shields, you can trade anyone. Now, having said that, Shields was making more money than Zobrist will make next year. So, but I do think that they are always striving to put the best team on the field they can have. And I think trying to educate their fan base on that what they're doing a lot of times when you trade a favorite to make your team better is something the fan base is going to have to get used to. You know, a lot of older fan bases are more team first and fall in love with a player later. I think I think that's one of the things Tampa Bay area being a young area with the team, you know, they tend to fall in love with the player more than they do the team. And I think that concept will eventually come with time. So I do think it's a consideration. I think it's an important one. But I think if they get what they wanted for Zobrist, they would pull the trigger.
And then there seems to be, I don't know if you'd call it a surplus, but certainly a lot of moving parts in the outfield. How do you expect that combination of players to shake down, either as potential, again, as potential trade options or as starters for next year, or just how do you expect that puzzle to work itself out between now and the beginning of next year?
Yeah, you want to talk about guessing and moving pieces. That's the one. In fact, heading into this year, I was surprised, based on the way they do things, that they did the two-year deal with DeJesus at the money they did. Now, it's hard to see, you know, what they got in DeJesus, even though he's a veteran guy. He was injured a lot of this year. My thought on him going into this year was that they spent more money than what they normally would for a player of his talents. I mean, I like DeJesus as a player, but again, you didn't get to see much this year. But if you go across the board with all the guys they got in the outfield, every one of them has some kind of baggage from this year. You know, whether it's Matt, Will Myers, you know, he was injured, you know, hasn't really gotten it back. Will he come back and bounce back to his rookie of the year form? I think he will. Kevin Kiermaier, you know, he's Mr. Hustle, all out. You know, there are questions about his hitting. He was a better hitter than everybody thought this year. Matt Joyce, is he too expensive? Will he be moved? Desmond Jennings, he's arbitration eligible. He's going to sit out the rest of the season. Brandon Guyer was a nice surprise offensively. He's been a little bit limited defensively, which is kind of a surprise given what a good athlete he is. So, you know, there's all these balls in the air with these guys, and, you know, you're going to have to, out of that group, you're going to have to figure out which ones you want. So that one might be the toughest call they have altogether in the offseason.
Well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter, Ian Brown. Ian, we are just about at the end of the year, and I don't generally like to do talk about questions, but I think this demands something along those lines. A very simple, a very broad, what the heck happened to the 2014 Red Sox?
It's hard to say. I mean, the one thing that just jumps off the page is the offense. I mean, the whole time I've been watching the Red Sox for decades now, I've never seen a Red Sox team that just couldn't hit like this one. And I think that was a big thing, was just that they were all year long, they couldn't hit, with especially with runners in scoring position. And it was really all year. You know, this offense never really at any point in the season had a hot streak. And that was, and it's just, I think it's a combination of that with, you know, putting too much on the young players. And I think that the thing, those two things went hand in hand, where you're counting on too many young guys to kind of contribute and carry a load offensively, and it just had a trickle-down effect.
Yeah, to me, that's the really interesting question is you've got to trust your development team. You've got to trust your major league staff. You've got to trust that the homegrown players you bring up are going to work, and historically they have. I mean, I think there's a pretty good record there in Boston, and yet they had two guys that seemed an awful lot like can't miss, who one of them might actually miss, and one of them at least didn't have the year they hoped. Do you think, like you said, was there too much pressure on them? Did the club just misread these guys? With Bradley and Bogaerts, it seems like, I don't want to put too much on two guys because obviously a lot of things happen here, but it seems like if that works out with those guys, then this is a very different year. So in your mind, what happened with those two guys?
Yeah, I think, you know, with Bogaerts, you know, I think we all lost sight of, you know, how few at-bats this guy had in his development, and, you know, saw what he did last year in the playoffs and just kind of figured this guy was ready, you know? And I think that maybe he fell victim to some of that hype, too, and it just was a lot harder than he thought. I think that he finally, when you look at the end of the season, he finally sort of did start making the adjustments, and he is making a case of late that, you know, he could be a pretty nice piece for them next year. With Bradley, that's a little more concerning to me, because to me, Bradley just looks like a guy who can't hit at the major league level, you know. We've seen it for long enough. We've seen it enough at bats where he doesn't look like a major league hitter. So, you know, maybe he still has something to say about it, but now, you know, you don't even know how he factors in the team's plans for next year, now that they have Mookie Betts and Ruzny Castillo and Cespedes and Alan Craig. So it seems like he's kind of getting boxed out. So I think that to me, Bradley and Middlebrooks are the two guys I'm not sure they're going to be part of what this team does next year.
Not to hammer them, but this is a really smart organization, and it seems like inability to hit big league pitching is a pretty big deal. How does that happen? I mean, again, is it just a misread, or how does it happen that a guy that they're confident enough to say, you're the guy and we're going to make decisions based on that, just doesn't hit at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big mystery. I mean, I think they've banged their head against the wall with both guys, with Bradley and with Will Middlebrooks, trying to get them to make the necessary adjustments. And, you know, in Middlebrooks' case, you know, he has had a hard time staying healthy. He had a finger injury, so you don't know if, you know, maybe the health is related. But, yeah, Bradley's, like I said, it's been the real mystery to them. And I'm sure they're going to reexamine their process this winter and how they work with young players and try to integrate them to the major league level, because, you know, the Red Sox had a real track record of success with these guys, you know, starting with that whole, you know, Pedroia, Youkilis, you know, Papelbon, Buchholz, Lester, that whole class that came up. You know, they all seemed to contribute to World Series teams, and you know, maybe this class just, you know, they're not as good.
We talked a good bit about the offense, and it's clear this team didn't hit nearly enough, but as we go towards 2015, they've already made some moves to address that. We have a pretty good idea of what some of what they hope the answers will be to fixing the offense, particularly in the outfield. What seems much less clear is the rotation. What do you think the 2015 Red Sox rotation looks like?
Well, they got to go out and get a couple you know, veteran guys. I think the one thing, you know, is that Clay Buchholz and Joe Kelly are two guys that are definitely going to be in that rotation. Then you got to go out and get at least two, maybe three guys. You know, you're going to look at the free agents. You have some money. You're the Boston Red Sox, so you have some money to spend. You know, they're going to talk to John Lester again. They're going to talk to Max Scherzer and see, you know, that market could be pretty expensive. So they have to be willing to reach deep into their pockets. But you know, certainly, I think the Red Sox need to sign at least one free agent pitcher, maybe trade for another one. And, you know, maybe one of their young guys will emerge. I think Alan Webster is a guy who has pitched well lately, and they're wondering if he might be able to earn himself a spot next spring. But, yeah, the pitching staff is going to look a lot different than it does right now, that's for sure.
The Red Sox MO in recent years, and it's, I don't mean to suggest they don't spend because they certainly carry a very high payroll, but their MO in recent years has largely not been those kind of enormous free agent splashes. They haven't really been a big player, it seems like, for the guys, for the equivalents of this year of Lester and Scherzer. I understand Lester is a very different case for them because they know him, but do you think that as this winter approaches, maybe they get back to getting in on those sorts of really big moves?
Yeah, I mean, you have to adapt to the circumstances sometimes, and right now the Red Sox has kind of boxed themselves into a circumstance where, you know, it looks like they're at, you know, if they want to, you know, a quality championship caliber rotation next year, they're going to have to spend on some of these guys. And, you know, they did do it with John Lackey a few years back where they paid, you know, pretty sizable money for a pitcher. So I think that, you know, they're just going to have to look at the position they sort of boxed themselves into here, and they're going to have to go out and, you know, spend big on at least one guy out there, and I'm pretty sure they will.
Are they confident that with the moves they've made, both at the deadline and in adding Castillo, that the outfield is fixed, that the outfield, they essentially know what the outfield of the 2015 Red Sox is going to look like?
Yeah, I don't think they know completely yet because right now there's a little bit of a surplus, you know, where you're talking about Cespedes, Betts, and Craig, and you know, you got Shane Victorino coming back from surgery, and you know, you're gonna have some guy. The Red Sox also feel they're a little too right-handed right now, so don't be surprised if this team goes out and tries to get, you know, left-handed bat or two over the offseason too, and then you figure, you know, where does that fit in? So I think if the Red Sox feel that the outfield is a position of strength, and they might be able to actually use some of the surplus now to maybe complement the roster a little better. Whether, you know, whether it's getting a left-handed bat, whether it's getting another pitcher. So I think that there's a lot in flux for the Red Sox right now as you look at the winter.
Is Cespedes a guy who might move?
Hey, I mean, stranger things have happened. I think in a perfect world, they would like to have Cespedes in the cleanup spot next year, but he does have a, you know, contract that could be pretty tradable there, and that there's only 1 year left on it. And, you know, as I was saying, with the, you know, the they have a real overload of right-handed hitters right now versus lefties. So if Cespedes is the deal that brings them, you know, the stud pitcher that they need, then yeah, he can be moved. There's no question about it. So then you have to go out and get another big productive bat. So like I said, this is a really fascinating Red Sox offseason. Perhaps one of the most fascinating I've seen in a long time in terms of all that can happen and might happen and how many different scenarios there are. Usually it's a little more clear-cut, and you say, oh, you know, we need to go out this winter and get a third baseman. We need to get a left fielder. I think it's not so clear-cut. There's a lot of moving parts this winter, so the Red Sox are going to be in the middle of the hot stove action for sure.
I hate to keep hammering on this topic, but it's, well, I'll be honest, it's personal interest because the guy I covered, it's still not working for Alan Craig. At what point, and I realize it's still not a lot of at-bats, but at what point is there some worry that there's something really wrong there, that maybe, I don't know. I don't know what the thought is, but he's been even worse since coming over after he seemed like a change of scenery candidate. What's the read on Craig?
Yeah, he looked really slow running. And, you know, they did a full workup on this foot. They didn't find anything. So I think what they're really hoping is that, you know, a full off season, you know, they feel he had a short off season last year because of the World Series. He never really had time to get over that foot injury he had last year. I think that they think that a full off season of strengthening, of conditioning, maybe just getting some rest will help him just feel better next year and then be able to, you know, be able to hit like he can. Maybe, you know, develop some bad mechanics and then also trying to adjust to new scenery here. I think it's just all combined for, you know, a really bad year for this guy. But, you know, I don't think they've given up on Alan Craig. He's still got a really affordable sort of team-friendly contract that he signed with the Cardinals, you know, a couple of years ago. So, you know, they're willing to let this play out and see if, you know, maybe a nice offseason. And this was just the blip. Maybe this would just be the blip in Alan Craig's career. This was the year he had a really bad year. remember Mike Lowell had one like this at the his last year at the Marlins. So I think that's what they're hoping. Is that he's a really good hitter who had a bad year.
I need to check on getting the tortoise back. One other thing, the ninth inning as of now seems like maybe a question given Uehara's age and given his little fade down here at the end of the season. What do you think they do with Uehara? And if he doesn't come back, is that another area where maybe they make a splash in free agency?
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to make – the Red Sox have never been big on the whole, you know, spending big on a closer. They've always felt like they can find a closer, kind of like they did last year with Koji. You know, it's actually – Mujica lost everyone because he pitched so poorly early in the season, but he's actually pitched really well, you know, down the stretch and has looked really comfortable when he has closed. I think he's 8-for-9 in save opportunities. They don't completely rule out them giving Mujica a shot at that. But, yeah, I think they still would like to bring Koji back, too. It's just a matter of, you know, what would the contract be? Would it be the qualifying offer? You know, would they be willing to swallow hard and just pay the $14 million and then say goodbye? Or would they'd see if they can negotiate with him on something a little, you know, something a little smaller? So that's, you know, those are the kind of things that they're working through right now.
All right. Well, Ian Brown, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.